Well, good morning and welcome to the first full panel session. As I ask the panel members to come up and maybe take their seats, I will just take 1 minute to introduce myself and 1 minute to explain a little bit more about the topic that we're going to discuss. Let me introduce the panel. Sir Craig Reedy, who you've just obviously heard from, president also of the World Anti-Doping Agency, Paul Bush on my right, your far left, director of events at Visit Scotland, Dimitri Kerkentzes, who is about to sit next to him, is the Deputy General Secretary of the BIE, the governing body for World Expos. Sarah Lewis, who has sat next to Dimitri, is the General Secretary of the FIS and AWAF. Simon Clegg, sitting next to Sarah, is currently the Chief Operating Officer of the World Expo in Dubai. Craig is very welcome to join. He will be sitting there. And at the far right, who I didn't introduce yet, is Francesco Ricci Bitti, who is the President of ASWAF, the Association of Summer Olympic International Federations. One word about myself. I'm Robert Datnow. I am the co-founder and managing director of the Sports Consultancy, which I founded 10 years ago. And we specialize in consulting to international federations, rights holders, cities, venues, and brands in sport. And we sell rights, we sell sponsorship rights, we sell broadcasting rights. And the thing we are best known for is selling host city rights. We act for a range of organizations, the WTA, now the Olympic International Olympic Committee on the 2024 and 2026 process, the WTA, and we've recently been announced as the organization in charge of finding hosts for Formula E for season 4 in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia Pacific. We also act for cities, some of whom are in this room, and most recently you may have seen the announcement of our a successful bid to bring the Rugby Football League World Cup 2021 to the UK. So, turning to the topic, and what does the future hold for major events? I'm sure there is a future, as to pick up on Craig's point. I mean, this is a period of, I think, unprecedented economic and political uncertainty and instability. And I think in that context, the global sports market has proved more reliable as an investment sector than many others. Partly, in my view, because sport, and I know we're going to be talking about major events in general, but sport in particular taps into people's, I think, enduring passions for teams and individuals. The global market, as Craig was indicating, continues to grow. It's said to be valued currently at between $350 to $450 million in terms of the spending on construction and sporting goods and licensed products. And between 2009 and 2015, the market grew by 7%. And PwC estimates that the market this year will be worth $145 billion. And that's a measure of the investment that event owners and host cities are prepared to put in, but also the brands sponsoring and the media organizations that are behind those events. There is also unprecedented growth, and this relates to the topic of China as well, unprecedented growth in corporate acquisition and consolidation in the event industry. And you know the examples of Liberty's acquisition of Formula One for a reported $8 billion and UFC's acquisition for $4 billion and Dalian Wonder's acquisition of World Triathlon Corporation for around $600 million, and their aspiration to grow the first $100 billion revenue company per year. However, in terms of this year's most major event, the Rio Olympic and Paralympic Games, and other events, the Euros across France, while these have undoubtedly been characterized by success on the field of play and commercial success and innovation in terms of broadcast and social media, there have been unprecedented challenges in terms of anti-doping, governance, and security. So, the questions we are going to consider are how can the event owners, federations, and host cities, the brands, and the media play their part in ensuring that continued growth and their part of the market? How can they differentiate one event from the other in an increasingly proliferated market? How can they ensure that their events are safe for the athletes that participate and the spectators that come to watch? How can they ensure that the events and they themselves are well governed and that best practice from inside and outside the industry is properly applied? And also, and finally, that their events are perceived positively, both nationally and internationally, and that promises made are kept. And to discuss these and other topics, we have our illustrious and eminent panel. I'm going to start with Paul, who I hope knows I was going to start with him, so that isn't a complete surprise. He does now. It just seemed appropriate because we're in Scotland and we're in Glasgow and we're talking about events, and we have a director of events for Event Scotland. And I thought I would ask Paul really just an open question about the future of events in Scotland. And when I look at the range of events that you have in Scotland, from major multi-sport events, we've talked about some, the Commonwealth Games, and you have obviously the European Sports Championships coming up. And I also think, though, about cultural events and events that really Scotland has created, the Edinburgh Festivals, which is having a big year next year, and a major anniversary, and also the Edinburgh Tattoo and other events that you create and don't acquire. I think the question I want to ask is just how you go about evaluating why to bid for, why to create, and what impacts you're hoping to create, and how you ensure that one event differentiates from another and that they don't cannibalise.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to Glasgow. Delighted to see you all again. I guess for me, the most important thing is to keep it really simple. This is not a complex world. We live in the events world, but I think people do try to make it very complicated. And the biggest advice I can give you is you must have a strategy. You must know why you're doing it in the first place. I find so many people don't know why they're bidding, and actually get halfway through the process and then fall down. So it's really critical for us in Scotland that we've got that strategy, that vision, that ambition, and we've got the political partners behind us. It's also important that you have, as Robert just says, for us, as we're a sporting and cultural national organisation covering the whole of Scotland, not just Glasgow, but the whole of the nation, that you have a mixed portfolio. And that portfolio is not just about having sport, culture and business events, but it's also about having events that cover geography, seasonality, small, large, community, etc. And then we'll dig into exactly what they can deliver. Some of our smallest events are some of our most successful in pro rata terms. So in terms of the benefits, you will all know the benefits. They're hard and soft. The hard benefits are easy to identify. I still don't think people probably measure them in the right way. In the UK, we've very much been driven by what we call the Treasury Green Book. But we're now very much, and certainly we are in Scotland, focused on gross value added. What is the absolute benefit that the event brings into the city, the region, or the country? And rolling out of that in terms of hard benefits will be full-time equivalent jobs, media, etc. But increasingly, one of the things that we focused on, and one of the things that I think cities and countries should look at in the future, is how does the event that you're looking to bid for, how does the event that's indigenously being built within your nation link into the cross-portfolio agenda of the city or the government? And for me, being very passionate about events is one of the few things in the world that actually can touch every part of a government's agenda, whether that be transport, education, sustainability, environments, young people, volunteers, coaches, artistic value, etc. And the articulation of that message is absolutely fundamental in securing long-term sustainable funding. And for us, that's the route we're now taking. The hard benefits are really critical, but the soft benefits, which you have to articulate very cleverly, are probably becoming increasingly more important. And two great examples. Craig's already talked about the European Championships in Glasgow in 2018. That's an absolute clear legacy of the Commonwealth Games in 2018. Solheim Cup in 2019, a clear legacy of the Ryder Cup in 2014. But probably for me, one of the most exciting propositions, and although we weren't winners, we actually won lots of other things. Our Youth Olympic Games bid, and I'm looking at my compatriot fellow who was on the Buenos Aires team at the time, Mike Lee. The great legacy of our bid in 2013 was that in 2018, Scotland will have a year of young people to celebrate the time that we were going to host the Youth Olympic Games. And then finally for me, threats. Matthew talked about being brave, and I think we need to put on the record some of the threats we face. Rights fees, to me, are a huge threat. I think rights holders need to understand there is not a bottomless pit of money in the political and economic turmoil that we now live in around the world. Transparency of bidding and governance is critical. Global issues such as climate change and security are now becoming key threats. And finally, for me, you have to have a quantifiable legacy when you're bidding for events.
That's excellent. Thank you, Paul. I mean, I'm conscious of the number of us on this panel and the amount of time we have. We may come back to those. If people want to ask questions, I'm going to try and make sure we leave, you know, good 10 to 15 minutes for questions at the end. So if you start thinking about questions you'd like to follow up, I'm going to build really on what Paul said there about evaluating events and bring in Simon Clegg really and think about but the crossover really between sporting events, major international sporting events, and it only seems like yesterday that Simon and I were chatting here about Baku and the first European Olympic Games in 2015. And now, Simon, with your role at Dubai World Expo, you must see comparisons and contrasts between the benefits that a city receives from hosting a major sporting event, as much as you see for hosting a major cultural and entertainment event, and it doesn't get much bigger, if any bigger, than World Expo. And I'm very interested to know, you know, what the attractions are for a city, but also what the attractions are for brands, whether they're considering, and you have this unique perspective, whether they're considering hosting a major international sporting event or a major international cultural and entertainment event, and I'd put BIE in that category.
Well, thank you. It's working. It's a pleasure to be here. I have to say, pleasure to be in Glasgow, where the weather is somewhat different to back home in Dubai, having arrived yesterday morning and been somewhat shocked. There is a lot of synergy between running an Olympic Games and running an expo. There's also a lot of major differences as well. And you know, some of those differences would be that the content is obviously very different. The participants are very different. National Olympic Committee is obviously in the sporting world, but national governments in the world of Expo. In terms of size, to give you a feel for it, the size of our site is some 434 hectares. That's almost twice the size of the Olympic Park in London, and it's slightly smaller than the whole of the Disneyland Resort in California. On which all of our activities will be focused. So you're focused on one site as opposed to spread over multiple sites. I think from a tourism point of view, of particular interest is the fact that we are looking to attract some 25 million visitors to Dubai in 2020. Obviously, the event goes on for 6 months, not just for 17 days. That 25 million is the equivalent of every ticket that was sold for the London Olympic and Paralympic put together, plus the Rio Olympic and Paralympic put together, plus the last two Football World Cups, and that still comes up somewhat short of 25 million. So a significant number of tickets to sell. What is particularly attractive to us in Dubai is the fact that we are focusing on the fact that 70% of that 25 million will come from outside the host nation. So the tourism, which is obviously a key driver for Dubai and for the UAE, plays a very important part in Expo bidding for Dubai, bidding for and now staging Expo in 2020. I think also we need to recognize that actually the world of Olympics and the world of World Expos have been around roughly the same amount of time. First Expo, of course, the great vision of Prince Albert, sitting now at the statue just above Royal Albert Hall, looking down onto his area, which had the Great Exposition of 1851 with Crystal Palace, and of course the modern Olympics 1896 in Greece. So actually the world of expos and the world of the Olympics, the modern Olympics, have been around roughly the same amount of time, but have taken very different courses, and the model is very different. And the IOC model and the host city contract is incredibly prescribed. The BIE model, which I'm sure Dimitri will come on to a little bit later on, is a very different model, and it allows host cities considerable flexibility and adaptability to ensure that it can deliver in a way that best fits the host nation and the host city, rather than perhaps best fits the rights holder. And therefore, it is a very different model. It's a very exciting model. And I'm very proud to have this opportunity at the twilight zone of my career to deliver something of such significance to Dubai, the UAE, and indeed the whole Gulf region.
Thank you, Simon. I wanted to bring in Francesco. We spoke about, Paul spoke about particularly the threats that sport is facing. You know, one of which is the way that bidding processes and transparency and good governance is brought into sports and sporting events. And I know, Francesco, from the conversations we've had, that you're at the moment deeply immersed in the governance task force, amongst many other things. I know you're keen to speak about the work of the Governance Task Force and these 50 recommendations, which I think are now being communicated to international federations. I'm very interested to know, and hopefully others will be too, about what is exactly being asked, what do you hope will be the answers, but I think more widely is, what do we hope will be achieved by this initiative?
First of all, thanks for inviting me here, and apologize because I'm the only speaker, perhaps with mother language very different from yours. But anyhow, I try to do my best to be clear. And I want to make first, before answering your question, I would like to make some context consideration, which is the moment that sports lives. In my opinion, the major problem of sport is the growing awareness of the relevance that sport has. And the relevance is at the top of the pyramid. Sport has traditionally a pyramidal construction, with the top, the professional sport, and the bottom is the volunteer and the grassroots sport. And the link between the two is not evident, as always. And this is the moment in which the relevance of sport is getting very popular, important, under scrutiny, and under the attention of the press, and so on and so on. And I would like to say, to give a sort of tribute to the press, even if it's not very fair, very often with sport in this last period of time, because the press inspire process. And the press, the critical moment, are the one that cause progress. I would like to mention FIFA, then I come to the, and FIFA has been considered corrupt. I can assure you, being FIFA the major member of my family, that FIFA is basically an organization that was managed very well, except one process. The one process was the assignment of the World Championship. And this was very critical. and so this inspired FIFA now to work very hard after the crisis to become an organization that is not only well managed, but is also transparent and better in this particular process that is very relevant to the finance of, obviously, of the organization itself. The second federation I want to mention, because it's always under critical attention, UCI, or the Cycling Federation, we have to give credit where we are now, and Craig is a good witness of this, of what I'm saying. If we are at this stage in doping, if we have progressed so much, we have to thank UCI. But everybody believes that UCI is the world of doping. Cycling has been the world of doping. I have to say that we are where we are in governance, in coping with doping problem, because not only the Cycling Federation was the major investor, but because they approached the problem in a serious way. It's the first federation with an independent testing unit, very independent, not funded anymore by them, except for 10%, and they have done what is known now as the athletic biological passport, that is a very important tool to find the cheater is practically not invented, but started by the Cycling Federation. Now is adopted by 20 federations. So we are in this progress. But coming to the question, the specific question of the governance integrity, obviously, much has been said already by Paul, and focusing on the assignment of the competition, if you want to link to the topic of this meeting, I would say that the International Federation, again, under scrutiny by the press and by many other people, decided that after many conferences in which I attended as chairman of the family of the major international federation, because there are other associations, non-Olympic, but obviously the Olympic are the most important and the one that manage more money. I was invited in many conferences, and after 5-6 conferences, I was discovering that I was always answering to my colleague in the panels about governance, about integrity, that they consider us very sick. And my answer was always that we are not so sick as they believe, and perhaps we are the best doctor for ourselves. Instead, we have many doctors around, and so I decided with the council of my association to start a process of governance ourselves, and we are at the second stage, very successful. We had the framework that was approved by everybody, and now we are in the second phase. We have a self-assisted self-assessment, and one item of the five principles that we established is exactly the assignment, the fair process of assigning competition. And this is very fitting with what we are saying here today. And competition, the bid for competition is getting a very, very important item, not only for the sport, but is one of these factors that link the grassroots sport with the professional sport, with the top sport. And as I said, the impact of a competition or of an event, sport event, on the community, tangible impact and intangible impact are really very, very important. And I appreciate very much what Paul has said. Paul surely is one of the best sport organizer and successful for the variety of events that he has brought here to Glasgow. I was a witness for my sport some years ago, Davis Cup, and I was very impressed by the approach. So it's very important, the legacy. It's very important what you pay for the right. It's very important. There are many factors, but at the end of the story, what is more important is impact on your community. And in this world of new media, where the community could be much wider than the one physical, I believe that all the people involved in sport should consider that to organize, to bid for event is a great tool to improve our life, our gathering to the friend, our passion, and again, to link the great tools that we have at the top of the sport, the professional, with the grassroots, with the young people that surely look at the top as a model. So one last comment, as I said, is that about the Olympic, because I'm obviously representing perhaps the top stakeholder with the National Olympic Committee of the Olympics family. Obviously, the Olympic has tackled this matter with the Agenda 2020, just mentioned by Craig. It's been an effort to facilitate the bid process, to make the bid process more elastic, more flexible. At this moment, the risk is that this tool is used to do what you want. And we have some example now. I'm going to Tokyo next week. And obviously, the people has taken this Agenda 2020 very, very seriously, because they changed about 22 venues from the bid book. And then this perhaps is too much. But I have to say that we have to be very vigilant on two aspects. The bid has to be fair, and on the other side, the legacy that the bid could be. One problem, and this is my personal note, another consideration that the IOC has not yet tackled very seriously is the size of the game. I believe that the consequence of these difficulties in candidate city, I'm a little bit the leader in this position, not very popular inside, but I'm convinced what I'm saying as an ex-businessman, that perhaps the size of the game has to be reconsidered. As we come back from Brazil, where I was a member of the Games Committee that meets every morning at 8 to 9:30 to consider all the problem, all the issue for 25 days. I have to say that I'm not recovered completely. I call the Rio Games the miracle game because the outcome was very good, very successful, but the behind the scene was very difficult. And so I would say that some has to be reviewed, some has to be considered in terms of size, in terms of 11,303 athletes, like the one of Rio that compete in Rio, deserve all our attention because they are the top athlete, the top model for the world. But we have to consider that we should not go to a level where this great, great event, perhaps the major event in the world of sport, is unmanageable. And so this brings, as a consequence, also many problems, closing the circle, many problems of governance, many problems of integrity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Francesco. There are a number of themes there, particularly about the way events are awarded. And I wanted to pick up on one particular theme and bring Sarah into the discussion. It seems relevant in your role with both the FIS and AWAF, which I know have similar thoughts and priorities. One of the themes I took from what Francesco was saying was about the responsibility of the International Federation and the responsibility of the governing bodies to ensure that the events don't grow so large that they don't provide a benefit for their host city. Thinking about whether or not there is a model of using existing facilities and a balance with using new facilities. And I'm interested just on your perspective about the work of the 2026 working group, and Craig mentioned about specifically about the decline in interest or the withdrawal of interest during the last bidding process and the steps that are being taken around winter bidding. I just thought you would have an interesting perspective on the responsibility and the role of the International Federation in these areas of the future growth of winter sports particularly.
Thank you, Rob. Good morning, everybody. I certainly feel very at home in a winter city. The weather is accompanying us appropriately. The ski resorts in Scotland opened early on the 12th of November with glorious conditions. It's not always like that, but when it's wonderful, it really is terrific. And the pictures we saw were fantastic. And there's good snow in many places around the world. They've just put actually out a snow warning that in high places in Central Europe can be experienced between 1.5 and 3 meters this week. So there's a lot of excitement there and holidays being booked quickly. Come back actually to the theme in hand. The Winter Games are approximately one third of the size of the Summer Games and a quarter of the size in terms of the number of federations who are actually running the events with seven sports on the programme, seven federations. In the case of FIS, we have six different disciplines and multiple different events, 52 different events. So a large number of events, but considerably more manageable than the Summer Games. On the other side, we do have a certain number of fixed facilities that are required for the Winter Games, which are not necessarily the most sustainable when it comes to post-games or post-competition use, such as the sliding tracks, ski jumping hills. And there needs to be good solutions for how to use their legacy. Now, from an IF perspective, most of us, certainly the outdoor federations, we're returning to our so-called classic sites in general. They are what form the substance of, for example, the highest level of the World Championship level. At World Cup level, you have a mix between your classic, traditional, well-known sites that have the facilities, but also developing and emerging ones, which is very important. When it comes to the championships, in order to ensure that the facilities are kept at the right level, not just from a competition standpoint, but also to be able to use for alternative activities, for other tourism use, for community use, and adding on sort of additional opportunities around it, there does tend to be a relatively closed group of organisers where we have fixed installations who can then invest year on year. And in fact, we have the organisers here from this upcoming year's FIS Nordic World Ski Championships in Lahti, Finland, who will be carrying out the championships for the seventh time, actually a record since the first ones in the 1926. We don't remember that one, do we, Yanni? But we're certainly looking forward to memorable ones this winter. So that's federations and championships. When it comes to Olympic Winter Games, we have a different situation because there we generally are seeing organisers, organising cities who are elected, who are not necessarily part of the classic programme of the federation's activities or even at a national level. They can be potentially involved with one or two sports. They could be the indoor sports, the skating sports. They could also be the outdoor snow sports. And then you've got the other federations who are concerned, well, how can we really here make best use of the legacy? Because you can't throw your existing programme out the window. You can't also say to the national associations, right, you've got to change all your activity from City X and go to City Y now because that's important. We demonstrate legacy. So it's a case of finding the right balance there. And one of the important actions taken within the working group that the IOC established in terms of the future Olympic Winter Games cities is to focus very much on using existing facilities. Now, it means changing the concept of having the most compact games. The most compact games have conveniences, but it doesn't necessarily have very good legacy solutions. So what this will actually create are opportunities for nations who, until now, haven't had an opportunity. They said, well, we haven't got a big enough mountain in our country, like Finland. We haven't got a sliding track, really, in our country that... And to invest in building one, we don't have activity, we don't have programs going on, and we don't really see that being a very sustainable option. And then there are nations like Sweden, a great winter sport nation in many, many sports, who have seen a door opening for them, an opportunity for them. So we've seen now there are four countries who are very seriously considering winter bids and heard of a fifth this morning. So this is, I think, certainly creating an opportunity that can be very, very good for the Winter Games to focus on using existing facilities if it means travelling some more, basing the different sports in different places. At the end of the day, what the viewer will see on the television will be Olympic Winter Games, and they may be spread with several hundred kilometres, miles between them, as far as then the Olympic values, the spirit, the village and so on. Well, already now the Games are relatively split up with mountains, with city, with the different sports that are taking place. And certainly that will just be... new solutions to be found there.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm going to bring Dimitri in from BIE, particularly on those points about the dispersal, you know, the multi-city approach that we've talked about before, and really to pick up on some of the points that Simon made about the way that the relationship between BIE and its host is structured quite differently in many respects from the way the International Summer Federations and the International Winter Federations go about creating relationships. Simon mentioned about the hosting agreement. And I wondered about your thoughts, just your views, really, about just how reactive, just the sort of relative merits, because my understanding of the way the BIE process works, that others hopefully will be interested in too, is that you wait for the first bidder to approach you, and then other bidders have an opportunity to bid within a time frame. And my understanding too about the Dubai bid is that they created the theme, you know, connecting minds and creating the future in a way that works for Dubai. You know, I'm conscious that there's the World Future Games in 2017. I'm interested in your view about the relationship between BIE and how you address some of these issues about whether you're thinking about multi-city hosting, the relationship with the host city, about the size of the event. Simon spoke about 25 million spectators and some of the relative sizes of other sports events. Just how you are wrestling with these issues and the responsible role that you are taking in managing that relationship with the future growth of World Expos.
Thank you, Robert. So it's true. It is a very different concept when it comes to World Expos from the Olympic Games or other sporting events. We have set regulations on when cities and countries need to, because it is a country that submits a bid for a World Expo, not the city itself. When the government has to submit the bid, and that's 9 years, maximum of 9 years before the opening date of the expo, it is regulated that a World Expo will take place every 5 years. So we'll have 2020 in Dubai and then 2025. So the moment for candidatures, for example, for 2025 has just opened now. Most European cities, Northern Hemisphere cities are going to be planning an opening in the summer. So now we're expecting to start receiving bids for 2025. There are certain cities in the world that have expressed interest, as well as their governments seem to be supporting this. And we will be receiving them, I imagine, between now and January, the first one. And at that moment, that's going to open a six-month window for other cities, other governments to submit their bids to be competing against the first candidate, with a probable election process that will take place around 2018, at the end of 2018 for 2025. I think Simon touched on it when he spoke earlier, where he said there's no prescription for a World Expo, and I think that's very true. This is for every candidate city and government to come and bring their proposal of how they see their World Expo to the BIE, to go through and see, does it meet certain basic criteria and regulations? And there's a very, very big difference for us as well. World Expos are not a franchise. We do not pass on a franchise to every city at that moment. When the host city is chosen by 170 governments at our General Assembly, they then have the right to go on and host this event the way that they see is the most fit for their country, for their city. And they have to respect a certain number of regulations that the BIE imposes, but they really are, they have a lot of freedom in the size of the site, a lot of freedom in the theme. The theme is something that is very, very important to expos, because this is, let's say, one of the primordial reasons why governments are going to decide whether I want to go to Dubai in 2020 or whether I wanted to go to Izmir in Turkey in 2020. They're going to look at the investment opportunities that such an expo can have to which one they're going to choose. There are a lot of reasons how governments come to the final decision of who they vote for at our General Assembly, but it really is it really comes down to the fact that we don't give them any set prescription. We give them free rein on what theme they want. It's clear that the theme has to be something that is important to humanity at the moment, whether it is a lot of cities are thinking about climate change at the moment. We know that Paris has a certain interest in bidding for 2025, and they have been considering 10 years on from COP21 and what has come out of it. We know that Japan, the government, has been very keen on seeing Osaka bid for 2025 as well. And the Prime Minister even mentioned the fact that they should continue the economic stimulus that the Olympic Games in 2020 are going to give them and bring them to Osaka in 2025. So it is a very different nature. It's a very different beast. And I think it also comes down as well to what an expo really is, and that is an expo is not an event that you view from home. An expo is an event of participation. It requires the public to participate. An expo in any given city or country cannot be done against the will of the public. It's impossible. You need 25 million visitors for Dubai. You had 22 million visitors in Milan. You had 73 million visitors in Shanghai in 2010. If you don't have the support of the public and you don't have this participation, your expo is a failure. It doesn't matter how many countries you attract to come and participate. If you have 194 like the Chinese did in Shanghai in 2010 or 130, 40 that the Italians did in Milan, it doesn't matter if you don't get the public in and if you don't get them involved in what the event is and what the event is going to offer them. One of the key things that we ask for, again, it's not prescribed, but it is something that candidates have to show us at the moment of their bid, is the legacy plan of the expo. This is key to proving that the event itself is going to benefit the citizens of the city and the country that it's being hosted in. It cannot leave behind white elephants. It has to show that the citizens are going to benefit from the hosting of the event and afterwards. It's something that we're very keen on, something that Dubai, for example, has worked on very, very diligently since the day they decided to bid, and something that we see the current cities that are thinking about bidding for Expo 2025 are taking. Probably one of the reasons why we haven't received a bid yet is because they are taking a moment to think about this seriously and to see how does it fit into the current scheme of things. In the case of Japan, they have the Olympic Games in 2020 and in a different city for 2025. In the case of Paris, they're bidding for the Olympic Games of 2024. This would mean an expo a year after the Olympic Games. It's not a first. In fact, Spain in 1992 hosted Seville World Expo, which saw 42 million visitors, and at the same time we're hosting the Barcelona Olympics. So we know that a country can do both events at the same time without causing any problem to either event. Probably one helps the other. So it's true, we have a very different outlook on how we come about to having bids for expos and which ones are going to be successful in the end.
Thank you, Dimitri. I mean, that's almost a perfect segue. I wanted to bring in Craig. Really just to think about some of those themes about the future of the Olympic Games and particularly, you know, the lessons that were learnt from Rio and Francesco touched on that. And really bringing it back to the theme of this session, you know, what does the future hold for major events and some of the most major events? I thought you would have reflections on the lessons from Rio in relation to some of the themes we're talking about, whether it's about bidding, which we touched on, but more importantly about the way that the city, but the country has benefited, and whether there are some of those lessons which will be applied to Tokyo and beyond that you've reflected on.
I think the best way to provide the comparison is to go back another 4 years and start with London. When there was a whole package of interest, the British Olympic Association, as you well know, had no money but wanted to run the Games. Our new mayor, Ken Livingstone, saw the bid as a wonderful opportunity to extract large amounts of money out of central government for his city. The national federations all wanted a new stadium. And at the end of the day, for perhaps our bumbling reasons in Britain, we made it work. We found that we could use put archery in Laws Cricket Ground, we could use Wimbledon tennis, we could play football at Wembley. It all fell together very well. And if you want to anything done in a city, run an Olympic bid, because in the main people come in behind you to do it. What we didn't do particularly well was the soft legacy thereafter, and I'll come on to that in a minute. If you then go to the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, up here there's a much better joined up thinking between elite sport and grassroots sport. And the combination of facilities that were built, a hockey centre for the National Federation is brilliant, and the Emirates Arena, where all the big events are held. If you go there now, it is absolutely stuffed with young people cycling or playing badminton or in the gym or whatever. So the use of the facilities has been very good. If you move on to Rio, Rio in many ways, as Francesco said, was a miracle. When you look at the way the problems they had political disaster, they had economic disaster. I can tell you when they bid, everybody thought they were wonderful. They actually had a very good bidding process. I give credit to the people who designed it. But at that time, they were politically sound. Their economy was as good as it was ever going to be. And 7 years later, the whole thing fell off a cliff. To actually deliver the Olympic parks and the stadiums and the new roads was fantastic. In all honesty, their basic problem was they didn't have enough people to run the games. That's where the delivery of services struggled. And I regret that, but that certainly is something that bidding cities and organising committees have to clearly understand, that the sort of legacy of new facilities is all very well, but you have to have people to run it. The International Federation's helped enormously in Brazil to get the games done. Going forward to Tokyo, I think what's happened there is that the desire to host the Games and the initial plan was designed mainly as a bidding prospect. They've had some political difficulties there because there have been changes in the Tokyo Metropolitan Government, and the new group in Tokyo, the TMG, are rather less keen on spending the money that was going to be spent to have compact games. And I mean, we went through this in London, and Brazil went through it too. That's why I say that it is endemic. You know, it's difficult to go from... You never really deliver the original plan. So again, taking it forward and you're looking at the 2024 race, it will be very interesting to see how people learn and how all of that develops. The Agenda 2020 proposals are certainly designed to make it more flexible, and hopefully that flexibility will work. There is no doubt that if you have existing facilities, you should use them, because out there are a whole bunch of cynics. I can't remember the name of the gentleman who writes books telling you why you should not bid for the Olympic Games, because you always lose a pile of money. And the one that comes out with some respect is London, because the cost of the city development, the rebuilding of the east end of London, the construction of the biggest shopping centre in Europe, all of that wouldn't have happened if we hadn't won the Games. And the rest of it has to be kept at reasonable cost. And London even made a small profit as an organising committee. I don't know if that's a proper summing up, but hopefully it will get some questions.
That's a perfect segue into and almost exactly on the moment that I was hoping. I'm sure there are questions. I don't know if there are sort of roving mics in the audience or if there are people who can. But if you've got a question, would you put up your hand? I mean, a lot of themes raised, and I can ask more questions if you like on your behalf. But I just thought there would be questions for many of the. I can see there's a question down maybe in the bottom corner here. Maybe if you just say your name and the organisation you represent.
Thank you. Name is Musa Kumede from Durban in South Africa. Sarah spoke about combat games, and then this statement she made was probably specific to Winter Olympics, where she said combat games don't necessarily make for good legacies. If she could just unpack what she meant by that, if I misunderstood, she could correct me. Thanks.
Yes, it was very much specific to the Olympic Winter Games, because there are a number of facilities, such as a sliding track that you use for bobsleigh, skeleton and luge, and ski jumping hills, which are not sports which have a recreational participation, that they're not something which kids are doing every day after school and have a huge community use. Therefore, none of the international federations involved with those sports want to see too many of such facilities all over the world that are just going to become white elephants and are not going to be used. Therefore, for a one-off event like the Olympic Winter Games, which is taking place every 4 years, which will only happen once in a city, generally, we have some examples of going back to certain cities, but only after 20, 30 years, so that in order that these rather expensive facilities which have to be built and used for the games are not rebuilt in new places where it won't have a use afterwards, it's better to be able to use existing infrastructure if it's in another region of that country or a fairly nearby other country, another place. So this is really the thinking now, that we try to maximise the facilities that do exist and do have a legacy and are part of international programmes and national programmes on a very regular basis. They are sustainable, than build more unnecessary facilities and be criticised for it.
Good. Are there other questions? Matthew, yes.
Can I just take the chance to ask this very eminent panel? With geopolitics and national politics playing increasing roles in supporting bids, would anybody like to comment on the recent events in America and how they see that might be perceived in terms of having any impact in any bidding processes?
Who is going to take that? Okay, Dimitri, brilliant. Paul, after. Yeah.
You know, for us, probably it's a lot easier for me to answer this question because since 2001, the United States withdrew from the BIE, so they're no longer a member state. That was under the Bush administration where he decided that the US should not be quite so prominent in so many organizations. What that meant was that they took away the possibility for a lot of US cities to host expos, whether they were international or world expos. They were unable to do that. Recently, there has been a movement since Shanghai 2010. Some big US cities have wanted to try and bid for a major world expo, and some smaller US cities have wanted an international expo, in particular one for 2023. And like you said, when we saw the results of the election, we imagined that probably the hope of the U.S. rejoining the BIE was probably over, and the hope for Minnesota for bidding for 2023 might also be over. And we were surprised. In 2 days, day after tomorrow, we have our General Assembly in Paris, and we were surprised that the delegation is still coming and they're actually still very upbeat about maybe convincing President Obama at the moment to rejoin the BIE. If not, some of the new administration that they apparently are very close to, and so they're not quite as closed to having such an event. So I don't know if we should take his election just quite so negatively on world events, but I believe the next 6 months will say a lot, so we'll see.
Oh, I know, Paul, I know you wanted to say something. I know Craig would like to speak as well.
I think it's an interesting question because the North American model in the events world, as we all know, is very different. It's very commercially driven, very little public sector intervention. I guess for me, and it's more of a commentary than a personal comment, is that if you look at the president-elect, he is a businessman, not a politician. And certainly from a Scottish perspective, for right or wrong reasons, he's invested significantly in golf and has produced two of the great courses in the world, and the upgrading of Turnberry, the production of the Menny golf course north of Aberdeen. So I would say the jury's probably out. I think, as you say, I think the next 6 months will be interesting. But I guess that certainly if you look at the LA bid, it's very much commercially, you know, and private money that's backing the bid.
The answer, Matthew, there's been geopolitics in practically every Olympic bid that I could ever think of. It just happens to be a bit livelier and a bit more interesting at the moment.
Absolutely. I think I saw another question over there.
I'm Director of Cavendish. Just a quick question, because it's very significant when I hear these discussions about legacy and cities having legacy. There's quite a few cities that I've come across here that are not in the fortunate position probably to have a legacy, maybe like Glasgow or other cities. It's probably directed maybe to Paul, to a lesser extent, Sir Craig. What advice would you give to some very innovative cities who have got some fantastic facilities, a great location, however, that they don't have the legacy? What advice would you give them when they're starting out the bidding process for varied hosting tournaments, from sort of World Cup to maybe sort of the smaller events? What sort of would you suggest to them?
I suppose the answer is in two parts. First of all, if you're bidding for sporting events, how big is it? Is it a multi-sport? Think through what sports you can fit into what you have, cost it properly, get political backing, and get a good sales team, and all of that's fine. But part of that then, and this is probably the responsibility of somebody else, work out the usage legacy thereafter. In the main, organising committees are there to run the event. They're not there to solve every problem for the city for the next 25 years. And this is, I have to say, not because I happen to live here, it's where Glasgow have been particularly good to make use that what they built was used. I've never thought that we were as good as we should have been in London. We are in trouble in converting our main stadium into a user-friendly football stadium. That could have been avoided, and I don't particularly want to go there. We also inherited a place called the Dome, which was a nightmare as an event, and it was turned into an absolutely wonderful arena by an American company who are good at running events. And we've just seen the finish of one of the great events there every day in the ATP tennis finals. Fortunately, they got the right result, but they also, over 6 days, sell 278,000 tickets for people to watch tennis. So it can be done, but you need to think it through and you need to plan it properly.
I think Craig doesn't want to go there, but I will for a moment. You know, I think with the benefit of hindsight, you know, that's the one area that we didn't properly think through with the London bid in terms of that legacy for the main stadium. But I think it's also important to recognise that, quite frankly, if we had gone to the IOC with a concept based around a Manchester City stadium built for the Commonwealth Games in 2002, converted for a solely football legacy after the event, if we had gone to the electorate with that concept, I don't think London would ever have won the Games. So I think you need to be very clear in terms of that legacy, making sure that even if you're thinking it through, you're not giving the wrong message that actually doesn't allow you to secure the event in the first instance. I think with the benefit of hindsight, we should have taken much, much tougher decisions in 2005 as soon as we had come back. And we're obviously now having to deal with some of the fallout of that. And you know, looking around the audience, I do see representatives from architectural companies here. You know, as soon as an architectural company comes up with the perfect solution in terms of how you can accommodate both track and field athletics and football in the same stadium without compromising sight lines, you'll be on to an absolute winner.
I think we have time for one more question. I saw there was a question up here.
First of all, my question goes to Sir Craig. First of all, my name is Michael Nagy. I'm from the Rio Convention and Visitors Bureau. Thank you very much for your perfect explanation of what happened in Brazil. But you forgot to say we were actually blamed for creating Zika as well. And we have to thank the IOC for betting on Rio and Brazil, which you did, and it was a fantastic Games for us. And the legacy was there. When you did your opening speech, you spoke about a little bit about where Games are going in the future and which destinations. You mentioned Europe, you mentioned Africa, you mentioned Asia, you mentioned Australia. Do the IOC see sporting events coming back to South America or Rio or Brazil specifically?
I'm sure they would be delighted if the South American Golf Championships were played on the fabulous golf course in Rio that you built for the Games. The Olympic Youth Games are going to Buenos Aires. The IOC session and a major conference is going to Lima in Peru. So I think we've got the message from that point of view. I have to say this, I was interested in the first presentations from cities in Doha last week. And Budapest made a very interesting presentation which said, if you want to bring the Games to a smaller city, we're only 1.5 million, and boy, would we be good at it, so why don't you come here? And I actually think that's actually quite an interesting message and one that deserves to be thought of. Now, congratulations on what was done in Brazil and the Games, particularly the ceremonies, I thought pulled Brazil together in a country where, with respect, so, you do need to be pulled together. together in
a big way
that hadn't happened before. So I think the legacy from Brazil is great. I really hope you can run the sports facilities well and have the legacy for young people thereafter. But from that point of view, and the quality of the television coverage produced by OBS, which goes all around the world, is a priceless asset to Olympic organising cities.
I think we may be, I can see the clock has ticked to half past. I think unless you correct me. In order to keep the time, it just remains for me to say actually two things. First is to reiterate this point about the questionnaire, which is in your packs, which I know Ben and Matthew would be very happy if you filled in and left before you depart. And then it just remains for me to thank on your behalf Francesco and Paul, Dimitri, Sarah, Simon and Craig. Many thanks.
Click on that.
That's okay.
Put the thing on.
That's okay. I might have to hop up to.
You might have to
put it back onto that when you start chatting. Again.
Okay. You might have to come up to put it.
Fifth slide or something.
I'll do that. When I introduce him, you just pop up and click into that.
Do you want me to put the presentation on as well?
Yeah.
I'll do all the tech.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fine. Okay. No problem. If I put the mouse there.
Yeah.
Can I do that without having to? Yeah, so I can do that.
Yeah. I wonder if we could come to order, as they say. We're about to move into the next session and very conscious of time. And it's hopefully going to be an interesting keynote and moderated session we're about to get into. So colleagues who are staying, please stay and do take your seats. My name's Mike Lee. I'm chairman of Vero Communications. You'll see in the brochure the sort of work that we do. We're a strategic and communications agency specializing in sport. A couple of our projects were referred to in the last session in Rio 2016 and Buenos Aires Youth Olympic Games. And it is a pleasure to be in Glasgow, despite that moment between Buenos Aires and Glasgow, because actually Glasgow is shown because of its approach, because of the work it does with Visit Scotland, with UK Sport and others, that actually there can be a legacy from bidding and not winning. And the work, I think, that you see in this city and across Scotland on major events is actually a model worth looking at. And I've had the pleasure and honour of working with Glasgow colleagues and Visit Scotland colleagues, apart from Buenos Aires, on a number of the competitive bids that they've won in relation to major championships. And actually, it's also a particular pleasure to be introducing this session where Jean-François Martin, who is the deputy mayor of Paris, who leads on tourism and sports and a totally joined-up approach they take in Paris, because over the last 12 months, I've personally become a sort of honorary Parisian, working with not only the Paris 2024 Olympic bid, but also with the Department for International Trade and the British Embassy in Paris. And we've been running also events through the embassy, which hopefully you'll see some more next year. We'll be very welcome to attend. It's been particularly stimulating working with the city of Paris, with the mayor and her team. And Jean-François not only leads on tourism and sport, but also on the relationship with Paris 2024 bid committee. So he's very much at the heart of the work that we're doing there as the bid. But his keynote today, we'll then have a chance for questions, so please be thinking about some things you may want to ask about, is actually on rising to the challenge of staging a mega sporting event, and in particular, the European Football Championships 2016, Euro 2016. And I think what you'll hear, and I think it's an important part of this conference and the work that Host City have been doing, is how can you not only stage a successful major sporting event, but have an impact beyond sport. This is probably the third largest sporting event on the planet. And the challenge that, the city set themselves is how can they utilize that in their planning, in their strategy, in their joined up thinking, their work with stakeholders, to have an impact way beyond football. And I think you'll see from his presentation the achievements that were finally put in place and continue to be a legacy for Paris and for France, and of course have an impact on the positive impact on the current Paris 2024 bid. So without further ado, can I ask you to give a round warm welcome, Glasgow welcome, to Jean-Francois, and Ben, could you load the PowerPoint? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thank you for all the host city team for the invitation of sharing with you today the case study of how we hosted the Euro 2016 football tournament and what are the learnings we get from this experience. As Mike said, we, of course, our first responsibility as a host city for this football championship was to deliver a great experience for the athletes, for the teams, for the media, for the sponsors. Of course, delivering great venues, football stadium. But this is the minimum contract. You have to deliver a great event. But what was our mindset is, what can we do more than just deliver the sports tournament, and to make this tournament a booster for all the public policies, for our promotion, for involving more than only football supporters, but all our citizens in this challenge. So what we offered during the Euro 2016 was firstly maybe a mindset. Our mindset was a permanent attention for all stakeholders. Sometimes you are fully focused on the right holders. Of course, the UEFA is a permanent holders that ask you every day questions about public transport, about safety, about your venues, about etc., etc. But you can't focus only on them. You have to be sure that for all these stakeholders, you will have a long-term legacy, hard and soft. For the, of course, UEFA, but also for the local population, sometimes major events give the feelings that the local populations are excluded from the event. It's only for ones who will have a ticket. Major event could be even for people who will not attend the games, who will not go to the stadium. It's a major event for everyone. For visitor, of course, we are the most visited city in the world, a leader touristic destination, but we need to use this major event to improve the experience for foreign visitors of Paris. And of course, sponsors. As you may know, major events are not only sport, it's business, and we need the sponsor to have a great experience in Paris to be sure they will still invest in the maybe less known major event we'll have, and they will still sponsor them. So our vision was Euro 2016 should be more than just a football tournament. And to succeed in it, we have three pillars: share it, innovate thanks to it, and preserve what needs to be preserved. Share, firstly, is sharing, of course, with all the population of Paris. Share with the elders. I just show you some example of the action we had in what we call the amplification plan, how we amplify the Euro in the city. First one is papy foot. It's mean elder table football tournament. We took children in all the schools and we bring them to the retirement homes to see lonely elders and to play table football with them. We have hundreds of them and a great final with thousands of children supporting the elders playing table football, a great moment of sharing between generations. We have the 20,000 Smile operation who provide 20,000 free tickets for disadvantaged families and children to get them the opportunity to go to the stadium for the first time of their life. And blind and disability football tournament, but as well, because it was very actual, a refugee football game to be sure that the football can be a way of inclusion and welcoming people who are suffering all around the world. Sharing with the Parisians themselves by making them engage in the competition and only for the city program of volunteer, not the UEFA one, not the French Football Federation, only for this social amplification plan, more than 500 Parisians act to be volunteer and were volunteer to discover football for the children, to meet the generation, etc., etc. Share also all city around. A major event cannot only stand in the stadium, in the fan zone, and that's all. All the city needs to leave this kind of major event, and this is what we thought. That's why we host 84 events 1 year before to the tournament in all the districts of the city to be sure no one will be forgotten. The city itself so far has been used as an unexpected venue for cultural experience, for sponsors, for exhibition, for tournament on the major public squares of Paris. To be the first venue was the city itself. But also share the best of Paris and the most iconic place, the Eiffel Tower, and the best for the visitors, but also for the broadcasters and the sponsor by setting the fan zone on the bottom of the Eiffel Tower. And this fan zone has become, during the Euro, the first venue of the Euro. More spectators here than all the Parisian stadiums. It was the first venue. So for the broadcaster, for the sponsor, it was the major place to be. And for us, as a landscape, as a postal card for all the countries around the world, it was a perfect location. We had to share it, but we have also to innovate, thanks to it, with the Europe Legislate screen that helped us giving more emotion in the biggest fan zone ever in France, 92,000 people capacity of the fan zone, so you need a big screen, obviously. But also, with the first massive connected monument. This is an experience I want to share with you. We had with a great sponsor, Orange, the telecom, French telecom company. We created the first way for the spectators to have a connection with the tournament, even if they are all around the world. Do I have some sound, Ben? I have music or not? Whatever. But every day, all day long, the spectators all around Europe can tweet, make on Facebook, choose their team with the hashtag GER for Germany, ENG for England, and the country that were the most support, that was the most supported on the social network, this country had the color of the Eiffel Tower every night. And so it was a moment of the day. Every day the broadcaster, at the end of the last game of the day, it was the question, what color would be the Eiffel Tower tonight, thanks to the connection of millions of supporters all around Europe. At the end of the Euro, it was 15 million people connected to the games to light the Eiffel Tower every night. This was a great innovative experience of a connected and massive connected monument. But also to connect with the youth audience, especially on social networks like Snapchat. We have the first filter on Snapchat to help the youngest population coming to the fan zone and to the venues to share their experience with their friends. But also not only innovation about sports venues, but also on touristic venues. And years before hosting, we had a plan to be sure during the Euro, we have the high-tech bus shelters, we'll have smart signage. You see the benches in Paris that were transformed in smart benches with especially a football look and feel. And an augmented reality application. When you are not in the games or on the fan zone, you can visit Paris with an augmented reality application to discover heritage monuments, all the district on Paris with a very innovative experience. But also innovate in the way we can connect sports and football with other background, other environment. And especially, we tried to make something that was a little bit crazy at the beginning, is connecting sports and culture. And especially we had this symphonic, philharmonic concert commencing at football games. I just want to show you what it looks like to replace a commentator by a symphonic orchestra in the greatest philharmonic venues of Paris. You have this great concert with people live stream live football game, and on it a great orchestra plays to meet culture and sport. And it was very interesting because in the room, in the venue, you had half people that were football supporters and half of the people that were culture people. And we met this kind of universe sometimes far, each of them. Last pillar, preserve, with of course a sustainable plan on share bike system for the supporters, fan walk from the hotel and the fan zone to the stadiums, and of course, as you may know, the best public transport in the world dedicated to help the supporters going to the stadium. And that's why we, and thanks to London for creating it, the ISO 20121 standard certification that provides us 164 action plan for maintaining water, energy, renewable energy, recycling, etc. And we got the standard, which is a great skill and a great learning for all the event we will host now. So this was the pillars. What was the result for Paris and for all the stakeholders? Firstly, 3 million visitors in Paris during the event, 1.2 million visitors in the fan zone, 92% satisfaction rate in all the sports venues in Paris during the Euro. We make polls and surveys. And in this kind of numbers, 30% of foreign supporters. On the touristic and economic perspective, plus 6% visit Paris request on Google. This is what we need sometimes to assess what a great event can have on the desire of your city, of how your city is desired as a touristic venue. And we use this data on the request on Google, and we saw a rising on request on Visit Paris on Google. Business opportunity for sponsors. We had great operation with Orange, this massive connected monument, but also, for example, with Abritel HomeAway, the most important competitors of Airbnb. We transformed the first floor of the Eiffel Tower in a flat where the supporters can win a night on the first floor of the Eiffel Tower with Abritel. All of the sponsors were happy to amplify their brand thanks to these iconic venues and iconic operation. And plus 5% reservation on OTA, online travel agency, for June and July 2016. On a major coverage for promotion, international promotion, 6,000 international broadcast stories, except sports stories. It's only city stories, a social program, fan zone program, 6,000 broadcast stories in 120 countries covered, and 1.5 million hours of live broadcast from the fan zone itself with the Eiffel Tower on the landscape. You can imagine what a promotion and touristic promotion it has been for us. But also it was the most important for us, the strong legacy for Parisian in sport development. We had the opportunity to share football with the youngest and to make sure more and more people would play football. But also millions of non-football fans engaged, people in culture, in startup environment, in innovation sector, in school sector, that was not so keen on football, but we involved them thanks to the program I mentioned. We had with the UEFA program a 2 million euros fund to renovate our local football field, and it helped us have this sports venue now for all renovated, and rising of citizenship and volunteering thanks to all the operation where the Parisian was called to act themselves. So this is now the vision, the pillars we want now to implement in the next major event we will host, the World Handball Championship in January, the Ice Hockey World Championship in May, World Wrestling Federation in September, but also the Gay Games in 2018, the Ryder Cup, the Euro Handball Women's Championship, and of course the FIFA World Cup in 2019. I've been Ben, as short as promised, 10 minutes and so on. So now, Mike, I will answer all the questions you have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jean-Francois. Well done. We could have given Jean-Francois 25 minutes, and he'd still be telling you more. It was an incredible success, the tournament, and if you had a chance to experience it, you'd have seen it firsthand. So we have got a few moments for questions. Happy to take any comments or questions. So if colleagues indicate in the usual way, and hopefully a mic will arrive. Any questions? Yes, at the back. It's a long way, but colleague at the back there. Thank you.
Thank you. Really interesting to hear. As Karen Airwhite from the Sports Ground Safety Authority, I'm interested in your views on sort of hosting a safe and secure event. And obviously with the backdrop you had of the terrorist threat, some of the clashes that we did see between fans in some areas of the country, I'm just interested in your perspective on how you manage that well.
This is one of the legacy I didn't mention, but the skills, the learnings, the experience we get thanks to this Euro about safety issues and stake is unbelievable. We host the third most important sport even in the world in maybe the hardest context and background we can know. We have terrorist attacks just 6 months before, but we decided to still host it, a safe one, but also still celebration, popular one, fan zone, etc., etc. And so we had great collaboration between national authorities, national government, which is responsible for terrorism threat, intelligence, with local and public authorities on safety on street, public spaces, but also the private sector, because the fan zone was more than 600 people for filtration control, check control, pat down process to entering the venues. And we had this great cooperation, investing a lot of money, I must admit, but we now know how to host this kind of event in a safe way, but still maintaining the celebration, the energy, the enthusiasm. This was the main challenge. Can we have a balanced way between safety and enthusiasm? And we face it, and with maybe, I don't know if there is a magic stick for it, but it's something between intelligence services, it's more than important, of course, of how you set and plan all the venues, the stadium, the fan zone, were set, and we thought them about these issues. How can we prepare all the field to face it? And of course, human investment. You can only bet on cameras and technology. You need people on the field. And this is what we did, and pretty well, I think.
Yeah, thank you. It's maybe a topic we could come back to in the afternoon session on safety and security, but thank you for the answer, Jean-Francois. A couple more questions? Yes?
My name is Terenty Meshurikov, and I am from Transport Directorate FIFA World Cup Russia. And first of all, thank you very much for this great event. It was very interesting, and I have one professional question. And in many events, in Olympic Games, in World Cups, the host city provides free public transport for the ticket holders. And I can say that transport was working fantastically in UEFA 2016, but what was the reason why you didn't provide free public transport for the ticket holders?
Firstly, because we have a very, very cheap public transport system. As you may know, the tickets, the public transport ticket for Paris is 1.7 euros per ticket. So it's so cheap if you compare to all the European system. Secondly, we have to be honest, ticketing issues with the UEFA. A ticketing technology issues to deliver the ticket in the same way, the transport ticket and that. But how can I say it? You have the best public transport system in the world. Wherever you are in Paris and suburbs, you are never more than 400 meters than a subway. So all this thing was dedicated. And to be honest, I don't think the free tickets is the best way to be sure to encourage the people to take the subway. Having a good system is the reason, is the answer. And this was the answer we had. More and more subway. For going to Stade de France, for example, we had subway every 40 seconds, I guess, on the line. One minute, 20 seconds. The 2 hours before the games, 1 minute, 20 seconds. Every 1 minute, 20 seconds, you had a subway to go to the Stade de France. This is the best answer. If you want encouraging public transport, it's not a question of money. It's a question of seamless, easily fluid experience. And this is the choice we made.
Thank you. We've got time for one final question. Yes? Colleague at the back there.
Good morning. Peter Mann, partner with Four Global. Jean-Francois, firstly, congratulations. Professional presentation and a delight to see you this morning. I am interested in the three pillars that you came up with, share, innovation, and preserve. How did that come about? Because I've just back from Lima, and we brought 200 people into a room for a legacy workshop. And one of the most intriguing things was these organizations, these people had never worked together before. How do you come up with your three pillars?
Well, firstly, our main vision was how can we use the euro for make a booster effect on all the Parisian public policies. So we passed through all the public policies we had right now in Paris, so transportation, environment, school, education, blah, 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 and we say, oh, how can the euro help it? How the 2 years before the euro, the tournament itself, can enhance our policies? And so we tick all the boxes, say, oh, on culture, we should do this. We should bring cultures that people sometimes don't go to the museum. We should take culture to football supporters. How can we do it? Blah, blah, blah. So we really browse all the public policies and try the way to enhance thanks to the euro. And after it, we have an action plan, and we say, okay, what are the purpose we want to now do with this? And so we had these two main things. We have this booster, now look for the purpose, and we find this purpose. Sharing, it's the DNA of this city. You know, if we like so much the food, we had a discussion with Mike about the lunch, why the French people stop the meetings for having a lunch. Because it's the DNA of the city, of the country. We need to share every time, and food is a way we share. And this is, by the way, a forecast of what economy is going. You know, the sharing economy, it's a way of the world is transforming. And if you want to connect with the youngest audience, they now want to share. They will now want to be more and more in cooperation and competition. So the sharing things looks like something very structurant for our plan. And the preserve one was obviously the sustainable thing. And the innovation is obviously one of the main things that can be injected in all the public policies. So this is the way we worked.
Thank you very much. Time is up. Can I just ask you again to say thank you to Jean-Francois? I think you provided some real insights into how to stage a great event. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Jean-Francois. We are running a little bit behind schedule, so we're going to extend the coffee break until 11:20, which is when the following panel session will start. So thanks very much.